Hello, I'm Ben. I'm joined this time by a very special guest, Jodrell Bank's very own Professor Sir Francis Graham-Smith. Sir Graham received his PhD from Cambridge in 1952 after spending time in the war working in radar research. He worked with a pioneering astronomer, Martin Ryle, and is now considered one of the world's leading authorities on radio astronomy. He was director of Jodrell Bank Observatory from 1991 to 1988 and became the 13th Astronomer Royal in 1982. A post he held for 8 years. Still at Jodrell Bank, he's Emeritus Professor of Radio Astronomy and remains an active researcher in the Pulsar Group. He's with us today to talk about his new book, Eyes on the Sky, A Spectrum of Telescopes, is a comprehensive tour of the history of observational astronomy, from Galileo's beginnings with a small spyglass to the huge number of telescopes we have today monitoring the sky at all wavelengths. If you want to know how a proportional counter works or how ALMA can see new planets forming, this is the book for you. Sir Graham, thanks very much for joining us. What was it that motivated you to write this book?
Well, you can't keep on being a frontline researcher for the whole of a long life like I've had. So after a while, you begin to concentrate on communicating your subject to other people, telling them how exciting astronomy is. And of course, during my lifetime, astronomy has developed just amazingly. When I started in 1946-47, radio astronomy really didn't exist. I joined in with what was called radio science, and we didn't realise then that we were, in fact, real pioneers of radio astronomy. But it developed that way quite quickly when we started to work on radiation from the sun and, as it turned out, from various other objects, including very great distances, complete galaxies at enormous distances, were emitting radio waves which we could pick up and find out about what was happening on those galaxies. Now, it's not only radio astronomy. After a few years at Jodrell, I found myself working at the Royal Greenwich Observatory with the job of establishing an optical observatory overseas, somewhere in the Northern Hemisphere. So I spent 7 years of my career in optical astronomy and looking at the design of telescopes and the organisation of an overseas observatory. That was a big step for me. But it's only part of the whole range of telescopes that we now have. See, radio and optical can be done from the surface of the Earth. Radio all the time and optical when it's not cloudy. But if you get above the atmosphere, then you can extend your observations to a very wide range. In fact, it's the whole spectrum, from radio right through to infrared and optical to ultraviolet and X-ray and gamma rays. Now, they all look quite different, these telescopes, but in fact they're all linked together, they're all doing the same job. So what really interested me was how do they do the same job when they're having to work in entirely different ways. That's what led to this particular book.
So I think we should probably go back to basics at this point and just ask really, what is electromagnetic radiation? What is light as we know it to be?
That's a pretty fundamental question, isn't it? Yes,
it is.
You could look at light two ways, actually. You can look at it as little particles of energy, photons, which enter the eye and hit the retina and make a little signal. Or you can say it's like an electric and magnetic wave. So it's a wave which you can compare with waves on the ocean. And you can focus these waves and you can find out where they come from, measure their strength and measure their wavelength, because the wavelength tells you what colour the light is. Now, the wavelength of light is very much smaller than the wavelength of radio waves. There's, almost a million factor difference between them. But they're still the same thing. Hmm. They're still electric and magnetic. If you go the other way, then go to X-rays and gamma rays, you can almost forget about the electric and magnetic part of it, but you have to think in terms of the little particles of energy, the photons. Electromagnetic spectrum is so wide that it actually looks rather different at the two ends. At the short wavelength end, we don't really think of wavelengths, we think of photon energies, like bullets.
It's often a misconception, I think, when people talk about, when I talk about being here doing radio astronomy, people often assume that I'm actually listening to the sky rather than looking at the sky. And as you say, it's exactly the same thing. And the way I often describe it to people is to think of it like sound, as in you've got sound that you can hear, and if you turn the frequency of that sound up, you end up in ultrasound. And similarly, if you turn the frequency of the light up, you end up in ultraviolet, and so on the other way. So it's, I think it is important to really reiterate that in all cases we're looking at light, but light just possibly light that we can't see.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the funny thing when you're talking about listening to things is that we do actually listen sometimes, because the radio waves sometimes have quite audible signals on, like listening to a radio station.
Yeah.
And that is the subject that I've been interested in for the last 50 years, which is pulsars, because you can actually hear the individual pulses sent out by these extraordinary concentrated stars. You can also actually do it with light as well, because sometimes the sun, our sun, produces an enormous flare, which is seen as light and its X-rays and so forth, and also very strong radio waves. And if you happen to turn your radio antenna, it might be the one you use for television, towards the sun, you can pick up this very strong hissing sound, which is the radio waves from the sun.
I wonder how many people actually have the sun cross their TV aerial and not realise what it is.
That doesn't happen very often. But it's true enough, actually, that the background signal that you get from your TV antenna on the side of your house actually picks up some radio signals, which are the oldest radio signals that we know of, that date back to almost to the beginning of the universe. It's called the cosmic microwave background, and it is a background radio signal which you can actually hear. It's only a small fraction of the total noise you get, even when there isn't a radio program.
Yeah, I think I heard it was about 1%.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yes, that's right. So you can't really say, I've been listening to the beginning of the universe, but it's there in the background.
Yeah. Of course, it's not something you see on TVs so often these days, because most just tune automatically, and you never see that static anymore, which is a shame.
No, that's right. You press the button and it tunes into about 80 different stations. And there isn't one of them which is called blank, no station.
No.
If you did, you would just hear this background noise.
Yeah. It used to be a thing I told people back in the day when you had the old cathode ray tube TVs that, you know,
you could see it.
You can see a little bit of the Big Bang in that, but of course now I have to just impress people with microwave ovens and peritons. So it's So let's go right back to the beginning of astronomy then, as we know it today. So Galileo is widely credited as being the first person to turn a telescope up to the sky.
I think that's a perfectly legitimate, fair and proper assessment of Galileo. He was an extraordinary character. He was a professor of mathematics, but he was interested in experimenting. He didn't just take the ancient texts and sit down and work out what they were saying without bothering to look at the sky. He wanted actually to look at the sky. So when he heard of the invention of the telescope, which came from the Netherlands apparently, he decided he would build one. And so he built a little telescope, and then he decided he wanted a telescope with more magnification. So he built one with more magnification. He was using quite small lenses, the kind of thing you would use in your own glasses. And he was using a concave lens, which you would use for short sight, and a convex lens, and putting them together. So in the end, he had to grind his own to get a strong enough lens to get big magnification. That's what he did. And when he had opened the sky by bothering to look at it, he saw the most amazing things. He looked at the moon, and he found that the surface of the moon was not just a flat, smooth surface, but had mountains on it. And then the most important thing was he looked at Jupiter, and he saw that there were little stars close to it. And blow me, the little stars moved almost from hour to hour, certainly from night to night. And they were the first planets. Jupiter was the first planet which was shown to have real moons. And when it got that, it was so exciting that he wrote it up in a little book, which became an absolutely classical. It was called The Sidereal Messenger. And the message was that the sky is not just a painted sphere that we're in the middle of, looking at the surface of. It was a real deep three-dimensional universe to look at. That was the real breakthrough.
He had some trouble convincing the rest of the elite. Well,
I think, like quite a lot of us astronomers, he was an awkward character as well as being a determined character. So when he knew the answer to an ancient problem, although it was very far from the established religious point of view, he just pronounced it and he wasn't going to have any nonsense. Mm. From being in a position of being in good favour with the church and with the aristocracy, he actually put himself too far out on a limb and had to make a public recantation because he'd deduced that the Earth was not at the centre of the universe. The Sun was at the centre of a solar system, and who knows what else would be discovered. So he was open-minded about that, whereas the standard point of view was pretty closed-minded. Mm. That's a lesson we could all learn.
Indeed. How did he discover that the Sun was at the centre?
Well, that goes back to Copernicus, really. Copernicus had said, look, if you want to explain these motions of the planets in the sky, the best way of doing it is to say they're all moving around the Sun rather than moving around the Earth. Mm. So that was there as a possibility and a quite widely distributed idea. So that he would know about that and he would say, gosh, Copernicus was right, you know. So this, I suppose, quite often happens when you get a theorist. Copernicus was, after all, a theorist. He wasn't observing. Who pronounces some idea which may seem crazy, certainly iconoclastic. Mm. Then observations come along and you say, well, maybe he was right after all. Yeah. And that's what Galileo did.
Eventually he was vindicated. So other people came along shortly after Galileo had made these telescopes and began refining his designs. What were some of those early developed
telescopes? That's what I was particularly interested in, which set me going on the book. amateur astronomers these days use lovely telescopes from 6-inch diameter upwards, and they know all about the optics of the telescope. But the big move was really done by Newton, I think, when he made the first reflecting telescope. He put a concave mirror at the bottom end of a tube, and he then was able to focus light over quite a large diameter. Well, people developed it. Herschel and others developed the diameters. Mm. But the great thing was that you could use a mirror for any colour of light and it would reflect in just the same way, whereas a lens has got what's called chromatic aberration, which means that light of different colours gets focused in a different way and you can't make such good images. All the big telescopes these days are reflecting telescopes, a bit like Newton's, except that Newton's was, you know, a couple of inches in diameter, and what we're talking about now is telescopes 10 metres in diameter. 10 metres, a big mirror. And the European Very Large Telescope, which is being built now, will be almost 40 metres in diameter. That's enormous.
It is enormous. There must be some serious technical challenges that come about.
Oh, well, there certainly are. You can't build a mirror like that all in one piece.
Mm.
You have to make it in segments, which you put together, and then you have to adjust them so that the whole thing is the right shape. And that is the one of the major technical advances. And the next one is to say, when we're looking at the sky with this large telescope, through the atmosphere, even where the sky is very clear, you get a kind of a twinkling of the stars, which turns out to be a random sort of refraction in the atmosphere. And you can actually improve on that if you can adjust the shape of your mirror. Now, that's a most remarkable thing. That's known as active optics.
Mm.
And, gosh, that's a technique which couldn't have been imagined half a century ago.
Yeah.
But now most big telescopes use that.
They must have really fast... So each individual segment of the mirror moves individually in response to what's happening in the atmosphere.
Yes. Yes and no. You can't actually move the big segments of a big mirror fast enough. So what you do is you have a secondary mirror, which is a lot smaller, part of the focusing system, and that's also either divided up into little bits or it's flexible with actuators behind which push it. And they have to act very fast, so that if you can find out what's happening to the light, the wavefront as we call it, as it reaches the telescope, then you can push the little mirror, deform it, so that it actually counteracts the distortions in the wavefront.
Mm.
So the atmosphere is busy trying to distort it, and you're trying to put it back again. And if you're clever enough and can make the thing react fast enough, then you can get images which are near perfect, corresponding to the enormous diameter. That is happening with big telescopes now. Mm. So, you know, there are a lot of technical things happening, even in light, which goes back to Galileo.
Yeah.
There are certainly a lot of things happening in radio, which is my particular field. But if you look also at X-rays, there are some wonderful X-ray telescopes working, which use some of which use mirrors, which look really rather different from the ordinary mirrors. But if you go beyond that to gamma rays, then you can't use mirrors at all. And you have to detect these photons like separate bullets.
Mm.
And you have a big tank which is filled with detectors. And you trace the bullets through the tank and it hits one detector after another. So you can find out where it came from.
Yeah.
And this is happening in gamma ray telescopes now and is producing wonderful results. All sorts of separate objects can be examined in this way.
Yeah.
So it would have been unimaginable half a century ago, but it is now all actually happening.
It does make you wonder what's coming in the next half a century, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So when did it become clear that the white light that these early astronomers were looking at from the stars or from whatever object they were looking at, when did it become clear that they were actually looking at lots of different wavelengths?
The idea that light was made up of different colours comes in really quite early. But I think the most important step there was when it was discovered that beyond the optical spectrum, there was still energy coming, particularly beyond the red end of the spectrum. There was still some energy coming, which we couldn't see. And that was the infrared. And the infrared turned out to be quite a substantial part of the spectrum, which our eyes wouldn't work at. But you could make cameras, things like the cameras which you use in your mobile telephone, which would actually work at infrared. So that there was a branch of astronomy which was a fairly straightforward move from what we could do already with visible light. The other wavelength ranges, radio all the way through to gamma, are really quite outside our normal visible spectrum. We can't just gaze up at the sky and detect X-rays. That doesn't work.
No, there's a big atmosphere in the way for a start.
Yeah.
How does an infrared detector actually work? Is it basically the same as an optical detector, but with a few settings adjusted?
That's right, yes. The detector in your camera is what's called a CCD, charge coupled detector. But it works like any other solid state device. It's got crystals which have electrons in it, which are forced to be in certain energy levels. And if you can make an electron jump from one energy level to another, you can actually detect this as an electrical signal. Now, to make the electron jump from one energy layer to another, it has to receive some energy from outside, and that is a photon. A bundle of energy hits it. And that's what's happening in your camera all the time. It's just amazing. We take it for granted. You just point your camera at something, a picture comes out. But what's happening is every little picture element contains these little detectors. And in every picture element, photons are arriving, making electrons jump from one energy level to another, and producing a little electrical signal. And so that electrical signal is fed into circuits, the little computer inside your telephone, and can be sent down the telephone line or just displayed on a screen. Now, if you want to do that in the infrared, you've got to be a bit careful, because the energy levels have to be rather close to one another. And it's not easy to make a device where the energy levels are close enough to take the low energy photons of the infrared. And if you do make that, then you tend to get a lot of random signals. You can help that by cooling it, actually. So a lot of the infrared telescopes have cooling systems, and the detectors are taken down to a few degrees absolute. Fortunately, you don't have to do that in your mobile phone.
No. So that presumably puts a limited lifespan on the infrared telescopes we have in space.
Yes. That used to be true, but now we can now build refrigerators which take you down to about 1 degree absolute, astonishingly, which are just a continuous cycle, and you don't have to keep feeding them with liquid helium or anything like that. It's amazing how well they work and how well they go on working, because when you launch something into space, you've got to have it fairly reliable so that you can be sure that your telescope will work for a year or two or 10 years or whatever the lifetime is. That's difficult.
Yeah, very. So we now have, from Galileo, we now have Hubble, and Hubble's coming to the end of its life, I assume, and then James Webb.
Yes, James Webb.
He's hailed as a successor to Hubble, but it works at a slightly different range, doesn't it? It works into the infrared as well as the optical.
Yes, it would work optically, but the main thing is to go into this infrared region and push the infrared wavelengths beyond what we can receive on Earth, because although the atmosphere does let through some infrared, you can't go very far into it, and the James Webb will work to longer infrared wavelengths, smaller photon energies, and extend the spectrum quite considerably, so that not only can it produce better images in the wavelengths that we can use on Earth, but it'll extend it into another part of the spectrum. It's also a pretty big object too, because it's so big that you can't launch this mirror all in one piece. You have to fold it up and stuff it into the launcher in such a way that when the launcher puts it into space, it can unfold and click into the right configuration, like an umbrella opening.
Yeah.
And when you've done that, you have to be sure that it's right. So you have to do some tests on it to find what shape it actually is. And then you've got little actuators which can push it into the right shape. That's going to be an amazing achievement when they do it.
Yeah.
It'll be, a couple of years from now before it's in space. But we shall all be watching that with great interest.
Will this be the same type of telescope as Hubble, in that you can go up into space and actually work on it, or is it going to be in an orbit that's somewhat inaccessible?
Oh, you can't do the same thing. Hubble, fortunately, was in a fairly low orbit by present-day standards, and the same orbit that you can use for space station and for the launch vehicles and so on. So that when Hubble, as it turned out, had a fault built into it, it was possible to go and visit it and put the fault right.
Mm.
Now, James Webb won't be like that. It's going to be very large distances, which are known as a Lagrange point, which is so far away that it's just out of the question for anybody to go and visit it. But it will be so far away that it will be able to operate without being interfered with by the any man-made signals, of course, but also from signals from the sun and from the Earth. And it'll operate continuously, gazing away from the solar system into the interference-free environment. It'll be a pretty good telescope.
So if you were to draw a line from James Webb to the sun, the Earth would be in the centre of that line.
That's right.
So the sun's constantly shielded by the Earth.
And at that distance, then that line stays, that alignment stays, because the orbit round the Earth and the sun is so timed that alignment is maintained.
So it'll stay in lockstep with the sun and the Earth.
Yes.
Always facing away.
That's right, yes. There are other Lagrange points, but that's the one which is used these days by quite a number of satellites now. There's a rather wonderful one, which we don't hear much about yet, but we will do, called Gaia. That's entirely optical, but it is taking photographs of the sky with a fantastic camera that can cover a very wide region of the sky in great detail and go on and on doing it over and over again. So that will be able to record changes in objects in the sky. It's busy taking measurements now. Soon we shall hear whether the sequence of measurements has been able to detect movements and changes of intensity. Apparently it's all working well, and it's going to transform our picture of the sky in ordinary visible wavelengths.
So if I were to put some infrared goggles on and look through look through them in the same way that Spitzer will be able to, what sort of sky would I be seeing? What sort of objects would I be looking at?
When you're looking at the infrared sky like that, then you see objects which are warm or hot, but mainly objects which are just warm. And there are galaxies which are warm and emit infrared. There are clouds in our own galaxy which are warm and emit infrared. But the ordinary stars which we see are so hot that they're emitting optical, visible light mainly. Now, the infrared doesn't concentrate on those. So instead of seeing the familiar stars of the constellations, you will see a background of infrared radiation from clouds and from various rather interesting objects which are not usually detectable.
So going the other way, back through optical and out towards the higher energies, what was the first ultraviolet astronomy?
There's only a rather narrow range of wavelengths at the ultraviolet end of the spectrum, but you can extend a bit from the ground. The first observations in the ultraviolet had to be done from space, and they were done from not satellites but from rockets, which first showed that there were objects producing strong ultraviolet light. And perhaps the most interesting part of the ultraviolet light is the spectral lines. We're familiar with spectral lines in the optical spectrum. You get a sodium light line from streetlights, for example. But if you go into the ultraviolet, you're talking about much higher energies and spectral lines with shorter wavelengths. And what you can see is, for example, in the light from the sun, you can get spectral lines from iron atoms, which are in the sun, in the corona of the sun, and they're clearly very hot because they've been highly ionized. Now, those lines were detected in rocket flights and were obviously so interesting and important that fairly soon there were satellites developed which could use ultraviolet light. And it's quite an interesting trick. The detectors are not too difficult because of the high energy photons, but it's more difficult to use lenses because they don't work very well as ultraviolet. You can do it all with mirrors, so you get telescopes which are practically all mirrors, and then these high energy detectors. They work pretty well.
So going up a little bit higher still towards X-rays, what type of objects in the universe emit at X-ray frequencies?
Remarkably, the universe has got a lot of very high energy objects, very hot, very energetic objects. Again, the ones that I'm interested in, pulsars, manage to produce X-rays pretty well, as well as they do optical light and radio. So that if you can get a working X-ray telescope circling around the Earth, you can pick up a lot of these individual point-like objects. And if you look at the light, or rather the X-rays which are coming from them, you can find it's pulsed in the same way as the radio waves from them are pulsed. So that they are X-ray pulsars. They're often, in fact usually, the same objects which are producing X-rays as well as radio. But X-rays also come from very distant parts of the universe, galaxies and clusters of galaxies, because inside clusters of galaxies is not empty space, but an intergalactic medium, in other words, ionized gas between the galaxies, which is hot, and it's hot enough to produce X-rays. nobody could detect this hot gas before, but as soon as you'd got X-ray telescopes working, then you could find out what was happening in the centers of galaxies, yeah, and the clusters of galaxies. This is actually very interesting in the present day investigations of the history of the universe, cosmology, because we're now investigating galaxies which formed in the very early days of the universe. And did they form individually, or did they form as clusters of galaxies? Was it a big hot cloud which formed a whole lot of galaxies, or did they form individually and then clump into galaxy clusters afterwards?
Yeah.
The answer to that depends a lot on X-ray observations of this intergalactic gas, which is a very important part of the universe.
I've seen some images of galaxy clusters comparing the optical and the X-ray, and in the optical you can pick out each individual galaxy in the cluster nicely, but you then look to the X-ray and it just looks like an amorphous blob, and you can just, where you're just seeing the emission from the hot gas that's drowning out the individual galaxies.
That's right. Well, you see, as you were saying with the infrared, when you start looking at a different part of the spectrum, you see different things. Mm. The familiar sky of the bright stars is no longer prominent, and what you see instead is X-rays, you see the hot gas, which doesn't show up optically at all.
So X-ray telescopes, we've touched a little bit on how they work. You have a few layers, and you can track a photon as it goes through those layers.
Yeah.
How is the photon itself actually detected?
Well, what's happening inside that is that there's a lens, which is tiny for your camera, it's only a millimeter or two across, which focuses onto a little flat array of detectors. I say a little array, it might have a million separate detectors in it, and the photons make a picture, if you like. Well, the lens focuses a picture onto this array, and each element of the array responds to photons and produces an electrical signal. And then the clever bit is how you make these pictures into a sequence of electrical signals, so that you can actually store it in a data stick or send it down the telephone line or through a radio link.
Going higher still into gamma ray astronomy, we see an even more different picture of the universe. Where is the dividing line between X-rays and gamma rays?
Oh, it's not a very clear dividing line. If you work up through the energy spectrum, we're starting with light, you go to ultraviolet, and then beyond that is X-rays. Now, in the lower energy X-rays, you can still use mirrors, and you can still have telescopes which look not all that different from optical telescopes. The mirrors tend to be rather a different shape, but you can still use mirrors. After a certain energy, if you get above a certain energy, the mirrors don't work at all. They don't reflect. The photons just go through them instead. Now, that technically is at an energy of about 10 kilovolts or so. Beyond that, you still talk of X-rays about another factor of 10 or so in energy. You have to use techniques which are really measuring these individual photons and how they behave. A bit like the particle physicists at CERN, you know, or any high-energy physics lab. You're dealing with high-energy particles. But where that merges into gamma rays, it really hasn't got a very clear answer. But the gamma rays then take over, and they go factors of 1,000 or more up in energy. you still have to use similar techniques, but of course it isn't quite the same. And so you, rather remarkably, you tend to look to the high energy physicists to find out how to build your telescopes. Mm. It's a collaboration in the end.
So does it become progressively more difficult to focus an image the higher in energy you go?
Yeah, that's right. You can't actually focus gamma rays at all. You have a big tank. It was originally done with a big tank of gas, and a photon going through that gas would leave a trail of ionization, like a meteor going across the sky. And if you can detect where that line of ionization is, that tells you where the photon came from. These days, it isn't a tank of gas. It's a series of layers of detectors which the photons go through one after another. And if you can measure exactly where the photon goes through each layer, and then you can find out again where it comes from. And you can also measure its energy, which is very important. So that the satellite is actually just busy collecting photons and sending information about where they hit these detectors. Mm. And then eventually you can put it together and say, aha, we've got a lot of photons from the same direction. That must be an individual object.
Yeah.
So it's rather a different way of going about astronomy. That's, I think, what's the most interesting thing to me about this range of techniques. Mm. They all do the same job in the end, but it has to be quite a lot different.
In terms of actually getting a position from an object in these at these high energies, how well can a gamma ray telescope actually pinpoint the source of an object on the sky?
Well, it's astonishing. It can do nearly as well as a small optical telescope. You talk about minutes of arc accuracy, which is just amazing. Optical telescopes now can go down to astonishingly small accuracies, real high precision down to not just an arc second, but a milli arc second is the unit they use. Mm. This is getting really astonishingly accurate. A radio can do the same. From the surface of the Earth, the radio astronomers are measuring down accuracy of down to milli arc seconds for positions of objects.
I want to go back down to radio astronomy briefly. So we're going back right down to the lowest energy part of the spectrum, the longest wavelength. But the first radio telescopes were a very different design to the type of dishes we're looking at here through the window.
That's right.
What were those first radio telescopes like?
Well, the design of radio telescopes, I think, goes back to early radar installations on aircraft. The first installations of radar on fighter aircraft used the kind of antenna which was called a Yagi, which is the if you like, the old-fashioned television antenna, which you often still have before people had dishes. Mm. And those were the kind of things which were installed for radar on aircraft. And when Martin Ryle and people like him, with experience in the war, came back to university, they set up very similar apparatus using the same Yagi antennas to pick up signals from the sun initially. And so when you wanted bigger collecting areas, you just built more of the Yagis and put them all together. And we spent a lot of time building dipoles and Yagis and stringing them together with bits of wire. And it wasn't until quite some time later that we were able to use dishes. The funny thing is, actually, that we used some German radar dishes, which were 27 feet in diameter. They were called Würzburg. And those were the first dishes that we used. I used them when I was measuring accurate positions of radio sources at Cambridge. So there was a transition from dipoles, yagis, into dishes, which was quite slow, actually. It was some time before the big dishes were built. Jodrell Bank one, of course, which first worked in 1957, was the first big example.
Yeah.
There's a new one now, a fascinating one in China, which is 500 metres in diameter. You can't steer it round the sky. It's lying on its back, gazing upwards. But it is the biggest dish. Well, the biggest dish that we're likely to build ever, I think.
Mm. Yeah, it's not easy to build very large dishes, really. I mean, nowadays, more often what you see when new telescopes are built is lots of smaller antenna put together. So the only reason, really, that FAST, or the 500-metre aperture spherical telescope in China, is able to be that big is because it's sitting in a huge caldera. Yeah. You certainly couldn't steer something like that without risking another Green Bank episode, I suppose, where it would just fall over.
That's right, yes. Well, you certainly can't build a steerable telescope like that at that sort of size. But this will be an extremely useful, quite unique instrument.
Mm.
Now, the other way to go, as you say, is to build a number of smaller telescopes, identical ones perhaps, and connect them together so they all work in one piece. And that is what's happening with what's called the square kilometre array. And this is an array which builds up a telescope which collects radio waves over a square kilometre. That's an enormous area. So that you can't build it all in one, but you build it in separate bits.
Mm.
And when you do that, you can make a decision, how are you going to arrange them on the ground? And it turns out to be a real advantage to have some of them close together, but some of them much further apart. So this square kilometre array will consist of a number of dishes, which will be, and that's hundreds of dishes actually, which will be spread out over an areas of a few kilometres for a lot of them, and then many of them kind of outliers, which can be in another country so far away, up to 1,000 kilometres away. In fact, the SKA, Square Kilometre Array, has now got two different ways of developing. And actually, they're in two different countries. There's the SKA South Africa, which has got dishes, like I was describing. But there's another one in Australia, which is the SKA low frequency or long wavelength, which uses antennas rather like the Yagis that I was talking about earlier. So they will be appropriate to wavelengths which can be around 1 meter wavelength, whereas the dishes will be appropriate for a centimeter or 10 centimeters wavelength.
Mm.
There'll be working in much the same way, on much the same objects, and in fact they can be combined together, but one will be SKA low, that's Australia, and the other one's SKA high in South Africa.
These days there are still some telescopes, even after dishes came onto the scene, there are still some telescopes that don't look like dishes at all. I mean, here we've got the Manchester University Student Telescope, which is still an array of TV aerials, and actually the array that pulsars were discovered on, you could be forgiven for not recognising that as a telescope at all.
That's right, it doesn't look like a telescope. That actually is following much more the lines of the dipoles or Yagi antennas. Mm. That one was designed for the long wavelength end of the radio spectrum, and in fact the way to do that is to build a whole lot of wire dipoles, and they have to be long to pick up the long radio waves. So the way that that was built in Cambridge deliberately to pick up the long radio waves was to put up a whole lot of wooden poles and string wires between them until you'd covered several acres of area. So that was a a very large collecting area made entirely out of dipoles, all strung together and connected together.
Yeah.
And it was that array which had enough sensitivity to first detect that there were in fact these regular pulsed signals from pulsars. So that was really the supreme example of dipoles, long wavelength radio.
I remember a quote from Jocelyn Bell Burnell that said by the end of the second year of her PhD she could certainly swing a sledgehammer, and she was involved in the construction of that telescope herself.
That's right. That was a kind of a tradition in the early days. We didn't have much money, so that we built all our own stuff.
Mm.
And I was certainly involved in all that business. We made arrays of dipoles, which were, huge by the standards of that time,
yeah,
but tiny by modern things. And we did them by bashing angle iron into the ground and stringing wires across. And it was a wonderful thing to do, actually. You made your own telescope, get your own apparatus working, and lo and behold, out come the discoveries.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
It must be really satisfying knowing that your discoveries have been made on something that you've actually constructed with your own hands.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. No, it's we didn't realise how lucky we were, really, because an individual can build a telescope, take observations, write the thesis, get your PhD, as one person.
Mm.
And these days, if you look at something really new, like, for example, gravitational waves, a paper came out only a week or two ago describing the way in which the gravitational waves were detected. And there were 1,000 authors on this paper,
mm,
because so many people were deeply involved in devising, constructing, using, interpreting, all the way through. And you can't pick out one person. It would be quite unfair to do so. So there's a paper with 1,000 authors.
There must be some politics involved in choosing the first author on the paper.
Ah, well, yes. It depends. The simplest way is to do it in alphabetical order.
Mm.
Now, if you look at the Cosmic Ray Telescope, there are papers with several hundred authors. But remarkably, amongst them is a chap called Abdo, whose name begins with A.
Mm.
Not only that, he has two initials, A-A. So if you look at the references to these papers of the Cosmic Ray Telescope, you will find it is Abdo et al. And al means another 299 people who took an equal part.
Yeah, I think any papers that I'm on where I'm not first author, I'm somewhere near the bottom because my surname begins with an S. So I'm rarely near the top of a paper.
Yeah. Well, you have to write a book and then then you are the sole author.
Quite, yes, indeed. I think I'm away off that. I'll have to get an idea for a book first before I write one. So we have the SKA for the radio now, and we have James Webb for the optical and the IR coming up. That's all come about in the last 50 years. We've made huge, huge strides in astronomy in 50 years. Where do you think we'll be in another 50?
Well, there isn't any more of the electromagnetic spectrum. There are no gaps left. So that what we will be doing in 50 years' time is taking full advantage of the different parts of the spectrum, which is now open. All the windows, if you like, are open.
Mm.
Which bits will be most developed? That's difficult to say, because the square kilometre array will not be operating fully for another, getting on for 10 years. And it will operate for practically the whole of that 50-year span that you mentioned.
Mm.
And that will be doing most of the work that you can in the radio spectrum. Now, there will be some specialised bits, and I suspect that Jodrell will be involved in that with E-Merlin, which we know about, and maybe it'll be extended, I don't know. Optically, we're only just at the beginning of the very large telescopes, the 39-metre European large telescope. That's going to be another 10 years to be built,
mm-hmm.
and that'll operate certainly for a half century. So where do we go from here? Well, that's radio, that's light. It's jolly difficult to build bigger X-ray and gamma-ray telescopes, but the ones that we've got there have got a limited life. So there will be new X-ray and gamma-ray telescopes for sure. It's going to be very difficult to build them much bigger, but they'll be there all right. So the whole of the spectrum will be fully exploited.
So gravitational wave astronomy began earlier this year with the detection of waves from two coalescing black holes.
Yeah.
So this is your second book covering the whole of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah.
Certainly in popular science, you've written more, but in popular science, this is your second book. You first just focused on radio. So will your third be a gravitational wave astronomy?
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, I'm 93. I can't go on writing books. Much as I enjoy it. Yeah. So I think that's fairly unlikely. I'll leave that to someone else.
Fair enough. It's very early days yet anyway, and we've only got a handful of sources, and we've still got,
yes,
pulsars have still got to detect gravitational,
yes,
waves.
It's pretty difficult, actually.
Yeah.
I don't see gravitational waves developing into the same productive branch of astronomy as other wavelengths.
Mm.
What it has done is absolutely marvellous. It's not only proved Einstein's general relativity to be correct, but it is also shown that there are black holes, which are a size range that we never thought about before.
Mm.
And, there is a whole range of physics that it has proved for us. But I don't see it as an object which is going to a wavelength range or a technique which is going to produce catalogues of millions of sources,
mm,
like radio and optical, Gaia, for example,
mm,
like all those wonderful telescopes have done for us.
Yeah, because sensitivities required would be enormous, really.
Yes, I mean, so far, with all this effort, and with those 1,000 authors, they've produced one very clear detection, and a second one which they had to dig out of the noise. It's real enough, but that's not the rate at which an optical telescope can operate.
Well, I think we'll bring this to a close.
I've enjoyed the interview, and I enjoyed writing the book too, I can tell you. But it's wonderful to see it actually sitting there on the table.
Yeah, we're looking at two copies sitting on your desk.
Yes.
And it's available now?
It's available now. Oxford University Press have been very good, actually, in helping the production of it, and I think they've done a good job.
Mm. Excellent. Well, Eyes on the Sky by Francis Graham Smith is available now from our bookshops. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. It's certainly well worth reading if you want to find out more about everything we've talked about today, and a lot more. So all that's left to say then, Sir Graham, is thank you very much for joining us on the Jodcast.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed that.